This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. If coronavirus is like a war, what else can erupt under the fog of war?
There are also a number of armed actors which seem to take advantage of the crisis, perhaps thinking that the world's attention is elsewhere or there's not the ability to respond as swiftly as there was previously. So, for example, we've seen a number of attacks by ISIS in Iraq and there've been a resumption of sectarian attacks in Afghanistan.
That's ahead on the show. And we'll take you to one of the most densely packed places in the world where the Christian aid group World Vision is trying to corral the virus. Let's start with what's perhaps the second biggest casualty of the COVID-19 outbreak, deepening inequality within and between nations. Leaders now chant the mantra that, quote, we're all in this together, but it's mostly professionals who've been able to work from home, sometimes in splendid isolation. For the rest, who haven't lost their jobs, they still need to drive buses and clean offices and deliver products ordered online. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz is the author of the new book People, Power and Profits. He's also co-writer of an article in the British medical journal The Lancet about COVID-19 and the new inequality. Joseph Stiglitz joined me via Skype.
I'm in New York, and we are seeing the way that this nasty virus is not an equal opportunity virus. It goes after the people with poor health conditions, and that's disproportionately poor individuals. It's had ravishing effects on those parts of New York City, for instance, where there's lower income. It also makes those middle-income people, teachers like me, can go on with our work. I do my teaching through Zoom. But those who are on the front line delivering goods are exposed day after day to the COVID-19. And another reason why they're coming down with this disease at such a higher rate than others.
You point out in your article for The Lancet, which you co-authored, that these people are not merely the lowest paid in many societies, but they're also poorly treated on a general level. How is the coronavirus crisis exacerbating their sort of already poor treatment that they may receive in the workplace?
A good example is that employers are not providing them with protective gear. In a few instances where there are strong unions, they threatened to go on strike unless they had masks. But in most of America, unions are weak and they're forced to go to work exposed to the COVID-19 every day. A dramatic example is our healthcare workers, not the doctors, but a lot of the orderlies, the people who are helping out, are very exposed and dying at very high rates.
Who's going to pay Joe at the end of this, not simply in lives, but also in dollars? If we look at the response to the global financial crisis more than a decade ago, in places like the UK and parts of Europe, there were deep cuts to public health and public service budgets through austerity. And it wasn't the fault of teachers and nurses that we had a global financial crisis. Who do you think is going to pay for the coronavirus crisis?
Well, that's a battle that's going on right now in the United States. And I'm sure similar battles are going on in other countries, probably more vicious in the United States. The state and local governments are being absolutely hurt badly. Revenues are going down. In the 2008 crisis, tax revenues went down almost twice the declining GDP. Yet, the Republicans in the United States are fighting against giving any assistance to the states. Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican head in the Senate, says, let them go bankrupt. And of course, the states are the political unit that's responsible for education, for health, and for welfare payments. So they're going to be asked to bear the cost. The stakes in the United States, all of them have balanced budget frameworks, which means that the revenues are down. They can't run a deficit. They have to cut back on their expenditures. That's why it's so important for the federal government to give assistance. The shortfall is being estimated anywhere between $300 and $500 billion or more. That's a good example of the ways in which ordinary Americans are going to have to bear the brunt. Meanwhile, the data that is coming out on where the money is going, you know, we had a first tranche of assistance of $2.2 trillion US dollars, and another tranche of almost $500 billion. As reports are coming in, where that money is going, it's going disproportionately to the very wealthy large corporations. It seems like the administration is not able to get money to the small businesses, to the poor, more vulnerable American citizens.
Is there anyone out there, corporation or any sector of the economy, that is really cleaning up out of this, that's making money?
Well, Amazon is doing very well. Yes, they are cleaning up. The reason is people don't want to go to the store. They're locked up at home. And if they're not one of the very vulnerable people who are left without jobs, left without income, if they're one of the people at the better end of the distribution, they're spending their day ordering things, getting deliveries of absolutely everything.
Although I did notice in the New York Times that the growth of a company like Amazon and some of the other tech giants that seem to be prospering in this coronavirus crisis actually makes them more vulnerable, in the sense that there is now a great deal more public attention on their awesome market power.
Well, there is actually a lot of attention on this for the pandemic. In my book, People, Power, and Profits, one of the main themes of that book was that the growth of market power in the United States is one of the major factors contributing to this enormous growth of inequality. And at the core of that growth in market power are the companies like Amazon, Google, Facebook. And it's not only the conventional market power, the kind that we're used to, but their ability to have our data and use that data to exploit us. So it's not only market power in the old sense, there's a whole new sense of market power, an ability to engage what economists call discriminatory pricing, making those who want the good pay more than others, often discriminating against poor people who have no choice because there are no stores near them. It's really something that is of increasing public concern, let alone to talk about privacy. So it was a concern before. It's going to be an even bigger concern now.
Let's talk briefly about your book, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. In your economics, you've always looked for the more profound questions. One of the most profound questions you raise is, you ask, what is the true source of wealth? Well, first of all, where do you see the true source of wealth? Is it Wall Street? Or is the true source of wealth now the doctors and the nurses who keep us healthy and the teachers and the janitors?
Exactly. Or let me put it a little bit more broadly. The reason we have a higher standard of living today than we did 250 years ago is because of advances in our understanding of nature, advances of science. And we're seeing that in the response to the pandemic. It was only because of advances of science that we could figure out why are people dying, identify this nasty virus, and then begin the work of developing retrovirals or vaccines. So It is the advances in knowledge and the people like the nurses and doctors who are using those advances in knowledge to increase our standards of living, to enable us to live longer, that really are the source of the wealth of nations. It's not the gambling casinos. It's not the people who have developed a lot of expertise in exploiting others. But that's quite different. And that's the distinction between those who are creating wealth for the nation as a whole and those who excel in taking that pie and grabbing more of it for themselves, what economists call rank seekers. And unfortunately, a very large fraction of those who have done very well have done well because they've been really good at rank seeking, at wealth grabbing, not at wealth creation.
Given the pandemic has shown the importance of collective community action and indeed, frankly, state action. One of the other things that you raise in the book is the idea of a new social contract, not exactly a carbon copy of FDR and the New Deal, but very much in the same spirit. Does the coronavirus crisis lend itself to the kind of new social contract that you're proposing in People, Power and Profits?
Absolutely. In fact, it is a really good illustration of exactly the kind of arguments that I put forward in the book, namely that we had lost our sense of balance between the market, the state, civil society. We had trusted in unfettered markets. In the United States, probably is the most extreme case, but Australia has had its variant of this. In the United States, we defunded the science establishment. We defunded the part of the government that's supposed to protect us against these kinds of diseases, the Centers for Disease Control. Under President Trump, they got rid of the office in the White House that was supposed to deal with pandemics. We turn to government when we have a crisis like this. But unfortunately, 40 years of denigrating the role of government meant that we didn't have the capacity to do it. At the same time, we exaggerated the powers of the private market. The private market in the United States was not able to produce tests, was not able to produce masks, was not able to produce the ventilators that we needed. Our economy, just like in 2008, was shown to be short-sighted. The way I've talked about it sometimes is, we lacked resilience. We didn't put spare tires in our car, arguing that most of the time you don't need a spare tire, but when you have a flat tire, you really do need spare tires. And that's the way we ran our entire economy, and now we're paying a very high price for that.
Just finally, Joe, as a former chief economist of the World Bank, you are clearly not someone who is opposed to trade. But at the same time, your book raises real questions about the failures of globalization for, you know, the working class, not only in the developed world, but also in the developing world. The pandemic has shown that the world cannot necessarily rely on supply chains from limited sources, particularly China, when it came to personal protective gear for medical professionals. What opportunity does the coronavirus crisis offer to, if you like, rebalance the globalization agenda?
It's going to force us to rebalance the globalization agenda. The undiversified supply chains is an example of the kind of non-resilient economic system that we constructed, as was the 2008 financial crisis, where a crisis in the financial system in the United States morphed into a global financial crisis. But at the same time, let me emphasize the dangers of the kind of withdrawal from multilateralism that Trump has been advocating. He's talked about putting restraints on the exports of important medical supplies. But what he doesn't focus on is the fact that America imports far more than it exports. And if other countries reciprocated, we would be in a really difficult position. So what the pandemic emphasizes is that we share a planet in the same way that climate change emphasizes. We share one planet. We have to cooperate together in solving some of the very big problems that we face. The pandemic is one. Climate change is another. So the kind of antagonistic America first or some other country first is going in exactly the wrong way. And some of the strongest responses to this have been through our multilateral institutions. No human institution is perfect, but they've done a fantastic job. The IMF, the WHO, the World Bank, they've all stepped up in a way that has been absolutely essential for addressing the problem of this pandemic.
Joe Stiglitz, he's a professor of economics at Columbia University. Joe is an award-winning, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. His new book, People, Power and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for the Age of Discontent. Joe Stiglitz, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Been a real pleasure.
Well, you heard there Joe Stiglitz talking about how coronavirus is exacerbating inequality, not just within nations, but radically between nations, between the developed world and the developing world. And that could be especially the case for displaced peoples. And one of the areas where displaced people suffer the most urgent needs is in the Cox's Bazar Special Zone. That's on the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar. The international aid agency World Vision has been working extensively in Cox's Bazar. And Rachel Wolfe is the Senior Response Director. She joins us from Bangladesh. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Andrew.
First of all, just give us a snapshot, Rachel, of just how many people are clustered into Cox's Bazar and the conditions in which they're living and have been living for the past 2-3 years.
Here in Cox's Bazar, we have the world's largest refugee camp. So we're talking about more than 850,000 people that have fled violence in neighboring Myanmar, mostly children and women. But the most important thing to remember as we talk about COVID-19 is that not only is it the largest refugee camp, it's the most congested. The population density of the main camp is actually double that of downtown Melbourne. So imagine what social distancing means when people are sheltering at home with 10 people to a room.
What? How many people might be crowded into a tent or some sort of substructure in Cox's Bazar?
Average family size is 5 or 6, but it's very common, again, to see as many as 10 people in these one-room shelters. And the shelters that the refugees are living in are still very much temporary. Tarps, bamboo, very, very simple structures. And to access almost anything, to get water, to wash your hands, to use the bathroom, people are sharing latrines with up to 20 other people. So it's very difficult to try to put in practical social distancing measures like you and I would think of for a context like Australia.
There's mixed families as well, I presume. Vulnerable older people in the same tents.
That's right. Now, thankfully, the camp population, the Rohingya people, are skewing quite young. It's a younger population, and that will help us in terms of morbidity if and when the virus hits the camps. But for the older people that are living there, you're absolutely right. They are living with extended families, with children. And of course, the burden falls on the woman in the household to care for the sick, to care for the elderly, care for the children. So women, especially right now, are highly, highly stressed.
Rachel, you said there, if and when the virus hits the camp, that contains within it a certain optimism. What is the situation with COVID-19 and Cox's Bazar?
Like everywhere in the world, World Vision and others involved in the response here are looking at trying to delay the spread. In Cox's Bazar district, we now have just under a dozen confirmed cases. And I have to give the government a lot of credit. They worked hard, along with WHO and others, to get the testing capacity up and running. It's still not where we'd like it to be, but we're making progress. Like in other parts of Bangladesh and around the world, testing capacity is the main determinant of what we know. So I think, you know, in many ways, it's a matter of time. Time is not on our side, but every day that passes where we can take more preventative measures, we can put more hand washing stations in place, we can get correct messages to the Rohingya. That's also going to save lives. Right now, one of the biggest dangers facing the Rohingya people is rumors, misinformation.
Of what type?
One of the biggest rumors going around the camp is that this mystery disease has a 100% mortality rate. Mm. Imagine what kind of fear that strikes into people if that's what they believe. So, you know, World Vision and others, we've been on the forefront for weeks now getting information to the Rohingya. This is so difficult because there's also a ban on internet access in the camps, which we've been working hard to advocate for. But in the meantime, talking to religious leaders, getting information out on loudspeakers in the Rohingya language, making sure that correct information can reach children, men and women, influential community leaders. This is going to save lives.
We've heard in other parts of the world that the coronavirus has caused a temporary hiatus in conflict. Is there any indication that the Myanmar government have softened or changed their position, been more accommodating of their Rohingya population?
I think that remains to be seen. But what I can say is that on the Bangladesh side, for sure, the government has been extremely practical and strategic. They've worked very closely with us, World Vision, other NGOs, the UN, to make sure that critical services can continue. So for World Vision, what that means is, you know, during normal times, we have upwards of 600 staff, as well as thousands of volunteers accessing the camps and doing everything from education to psychosocial counseling. Now we've scaled down to the woman, to the man. We are making sure that only essential aid workers are accessing the camp and that all of our activities have a direct connection to helping people get stronger, survive, feeding 250,000 people, making sure that there's soap, making sure people have those life-saving messages. That's what we're focused on now.
Yeah, you've talked about the importance of even trying to maintain some semblance of social distancing in almost impossible circumstances. And you talked about getting soap to people. Soap is useless without water. Is there accessible clean water where people can wash?
Thankfully, yes. Water supply is not a problem in the Rohingya camps. Remember, people are living in very, very limited small shelters, so almost everything is outside of their homes. Hand washing, they have to leave their home to do that. Latrines are shared by up to 20 other people. If they're going to collect their food rations, if they're going to access nutrition services, they're leaving their shelter. But the other thing that is helping us is children, young people, women, religious leaders, everyone has been trained for some time on the importance of hand washing. So now we're building on that. We have a really good foundation. So that's something that we can be proud of that is also going to help save lives.
If we take as a baseline emotion that there is a lot of desperation and a lot of need in these camps, how is morale generally in a place like Cox's Bazar at a time like this?
For the refugees and the neighbors that live close to them, normalized a bit and people got into routines, starting to think about the future. One of the most important things World Vision has been doing is to make sure children access daily routines. They have learning centers that are run by World Vision and others. Now we have children cooped up at home, not having these daily activities that give them joy, give them normality. We have mothers trying to care for their children and care for elderly relatives at the same time. And then the local people in Cox's Bazar also, anxiety increasing as they are locked down at home. And so the government and World Vision and others, we're working now to say, how do we make sure agriculture continues? How do we ensure these calming, accurate messages so that the local people and the Rohingya can continue to live at peace? I have to say, you know, the funding from Australia that World Vision is working with also has been a key part of making sure that we don't forget about the most vulnerable.
It's good to talk to you. Rachel Wolf, she is the Senior Response Director for World Vision, and she works in the Cox's Bazar area on the border of Bangladesh and Burma. Rachel, many thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Andrew.
Finally today, in some European cities, soldiers have appeared on the streets to enforce the strict lockdown measures against COVID-19. National governments are focused almost single-handedly on fighting the virus and propping up their economies. But leaders speak of coronavirus as a war. And under the fog of war, other crises erupt. And that includes sectarian and religious tensions that could now go unchecked. Dr. Eleanor Gordon of the Gender, Peace and Security Centre at Monash University has been writing about this issue.
The world's attention is currently on crises at home, so we're very much focused on the threat that we're facing from COVID-19 here in Australia and elsewhere. But actually, it's going to be the conflict-affected environments, the war zones, that are going to be very badly hit. And that's for a number of reasons. They have damaged health systems, or they're completely destroyed. There is a lack of medical equipment, ventilators, personal protective equipment. The people are very vulnerable. They already have, many of them, weak immune systems because of years of limited access to food and healthcare, lack of access to clean water or malnutrition, and they are unable to socially distance themselves from each other, particularly if they're in displacement camps or refugee camps, such as in Somalia or Nigeria or Cox's Bazar Moira camp in Greece and so on. On top of that, there's a lack of trust in authorities and health systems. So they're unlikely to respond favourably to any health information that they get about how to protect themselves.
I know there's another issue too that you've written about, and it's interesting to reflect on this because 75 years ago at this time, the world, World War II was ending. And if I recall my history correctly, the worst parts of the Nazi violence occurred as they became more desperate in their impending defeat. And there was the so-called, you know, violence under the fog of war. Coronavirus is not a war, but the war analogy is invoked often. Where do you think coronavirus could be used as a sort of cover for increasing violence?
We're currently seeing, whilst there's been a positive response to the UN Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire, what we're actually seeing is some states are taking advantage of the crisis to repress or persecute people. For example, lockdowns in Yemen are preventing people from accessing food. There are also a number of armed actors which seem to take advantage of the crisis, perhaps thinking that the world's attention is elsewhere or there's not the ability to respond as swiftly as there was previously. So, for example, we've seen a number of attacks by ISIS in Iraq, and there have been a resumption of sectarian attacks in Afghanistan. And also, a number of states and groups might take advantage of instability to make political and economic gains. And we saw that this happened during the Ebola outbreak, causing instability in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. So there is real cause for concern. Even many of the countries where there have been positive responses to the UN Secretary General's call for ceasefires, and where parties to the conflict have declared a ceasefire, there have been often caveats or conditions to those ceasefires, and even outbreaks of hostilities in many of those countries where ceasefires have been declared.
Yeah, I was going to raise that with you because we did read that, I think, in the Philippines, where there's a sectarian low-level war that's been going on for years, but also in parts of Yemen, I did read where they had put down their weapons or at least stopped firing. But you say, what, that's all very fragile?
It is very fragile. There are two things that could happen to make those declarations less fragile. If there was a UN Security Council resolution endorsing the UN Secretary General's call for global ceasefires, which we're anticipating any day now, but it really needs to happen quickly, there also needs to be monitoring of ceasefires so that if there are any hostilities that are breaking out, the world's attention is drawn to them. So the parties to the conflict are held accountable. So you raise the example of Philippines. The New People's Army, for example, has recently extended its ceasefire, but the government has not extended its ceasefire. So it elapsed on the 15th of April. Part of the reason is because there's a lack of trust between the parties. So if these clashes were monitored and the ceasefire was monitored more effectively, then they're likely to hold.
There is, Eleanor, though, a precedent for at least some sort of durable ceasefire during a crisis. What happened in Aceh back in 2004 when the tsunami hit Indonesia?
Well, that led to a sustainable peace. So I think what we're seeing now and what we're concerned about is that these declarations of ceasefires are going to be short-lived, because the dynamics of the conflict and the causes of the conflict are not being addressed. But in 2004, after the tsunami, there was a lasting peace in Aceh. And partly that's because there was a recognition that there's a bigger threat being faced. But partly, in fact, probably more so, it was because the world's attention was now on the area. So the Indonesian government was more likely to respond favorably to calls for ceasefire. And also the Free Aceh movement recognized that it could be seen as a legitimate party taken seriously by the international community. So it was the fact that the international community was focusing much more attention on this conflict that led to a sustainable peace there.
You mentioned earlier that the self-styled Islamic State group had been trying to resuscitate its war in, I'm assuming, Iraq and Syria. How has it specifically taken advantage of the coronavirus crisis?
I think it's certainly recognizing that there's less ability and inclination on the part of state actors to respond to any movements it may take. So there was a recent publication and it was calling its members to take advantage of the instability and crisis at the moment. So of course you see in Iraq that the government is very much focused on responding to the threat posed by COVID-19 and taking all necessary measures to ensure that any outbreak is contained. And so that there is an opportunity here for ISIS and also other non-state armed groups to utilize that opportunity to perhaps gain ground.
We haven't in Western democracies quite yet seen armed tanks rolling down boulevards in the cities to regulate people's behaviour. But we have seen the armies deployed to assist the fight against coronavirus in lots of Western countries. What are the implications of that for international hotspots where there are conflict?
The concern is that if there are resumptions in conflict, or if conflict is sustained or it escalates, few UN member states, for example, are going to be willing to deploy troops to help keep the peace. So there is a concern there, and it's not just peacekeeping forces, but it's also broader development actors, peacebuilding actors. Many of them can't travel. Many of them have been repatriated or are trying to work remotely. And of course, you can't assist people in need in conflict-affected environments if you're coordinating from a hotel room or from outside the country. So there's real concern there that there aren't simply the resources to be able to respond to COVID-19 or the conflict or other humanitarian crises.
Dr. Eleanor Gordon of the Gender, Peace and Security Centre at Monash University, and there are links to her articles at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage. And that's it for this week. You can catch us anytime on the podcast or at iTunes. Thanks to Muditha Dias and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.